Good morning, everyone. We are here at the Court of Appeals, 23rd day of March, 2022, ready for the 1010 oral argument, which is case number A21-1503 in the matter of the welfare of the child of BH and DH, Commissioner of Human Services, legal custodian. It's my understanding that there is going to be a sharing of oral argument time between respondents, and the sharing will be equal, 7.5 minutes each. Is that correct? I could be wrong, so correct me if I am.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Excellent. As always, I'll let the people know that we are creating an audio recording of the hearing, which will be available to the public. So we need to be sure we understand who is speaking at each leg of the argument, especially when we're going to have a sharing of respondents' argument. So each of you should be sure to introduce yourself for the record immediately before presenting your argument. With that, we are ready to hear from counsel for appellants. Please introduce yourself and begin your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Rachel Osband. I'm here on behalf of the appellants. I do have a cold, so I apologize if I get sniffly during this. So this morning, the court is being asked to address whether the district court in this case erred as a matter of law in conflating issues about exclusivity of placement with provisions about rule out of relatives under 260C.607, which discusses suitability of placement, then leading to appellants being unable to bring a motion for adaptive placement, which is the only way that a party can question how the county went about its decision-making about a permanent placement for adoption. And that's a reasonableness standard. So we have an issue here with conflation of multiple different standards and provisions within the juvenile code, leading to appellants being basically locked out of this case, despite their significant history with the child, despite all they have done for this child to try to get this child supports and services. And as a result of that, we now have a child who, according to the last review hearing just this month, is 10, has been in out-of-home placement for over 1,000 days, is still not in an adaptive placement. No other adaptive placement has been made, has been hospitalized twice in this review period, and is now on the wait list for residential treatment, which is all that appellants were asking for to begin with.
Counsel, can I stop you? This is Judge Larkin with a question.
Yes.
And, I appreciate your arguments about conflating the issues, and I admittedly had that sense when I was looking at this file, but the question I kept coming back to is a bigger picture one. As I understand it, the standard for permissive intervention is whether or not intervention would be in the best interest of the child. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And just to clarify,
and so does the district court's order, you know, regardless of, you know, what you allege to be erroneous reliance on standards or statutes, which have nothing to do with that issue, does the district court's order nonetheless suggest that it's not in the child's best interest to have your client intervene in this proceeding? So that's sort of big picture before, if you would, before you get to conflating of the issues in the law.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think that's what the district court was attempting to do, but I think it's very clear under MLS that the district court is not allowed to make decisions about best interests of the child under the 10 best interest factors under 260C.212 when looking at best interest for intervention, that they're two separate questions. I will also note that we didn't actually appeal the intervention decision. We appealed the rule out decision, the decision saying, not only can you not intervene, fine, we can't intervene. We didn't actually appeal that because if we were able to bring a motion for adaptive placement, that in effect gives us the status we need to move forward with questioning the placement of the child.
And I appreciate that clarification, because then I need to ask you this. It seems to be inconsistent to say that there's error here that warrants reversal because the district court inappropriately conflated the rule out with the intervention, which would suggest you're challenging the decision on intervention. Mm-hmm. But now you're saying the district court erroneously concluded that they should be ruled out, which makes it seem like, you know, you want us to tackle the judge's application of that statute. So it seems odd to say the judge shouldn't have relied on that statute in making the decision. Could you just clarify your theory for me?
Well, there are different rules, right? So intervention is, you know, under Rule 34. And I think MLS makes it very clear that even if we're questioning the intervention decision needs to be based on the best interest of the child pertaining to this party intervening, given their knowledge of the child.
You're not challenging that. You're challenging.
Right. So what I'm saying is, even if we had
clients are ruled out as adoptive placement.
Exactly. Option. Because there's many, many times, I would say 90% of the time, a district court denies intervention for foster parents who no longer have the child or for relatives where the county does not wish to place with them. But you're still allowed to move forward with the motion for adoptive placement, even if you're not allowed to intervene in the case. That is our distinction, is we don't have that option anymore to move forward with the motion for adoptive placement. Does that answer your question?
It does. How did the district court err in your opinion in resolving the rule out question?
So in our opinion, they erred in a number of ways. The first is that the issue that came up was a motion for intervention. 2 days before the motion for intervention, our clients get notice, if you will, that there is basically in the form of a responsive pleading that the county is now moving for rule out. They had no ability to respond to that. They had no ability to review what the allegations were or submit a responsive affidavit prior to the hearing. So then we have
But at that time, the child had been placed with a different foster family. So your clients were no longer the fostering parents.
That's correct. But the motion that the reason the court heard the case was because we had a motion for intervention. So we have a scheduled motion for intervention. 2 days before, the department comes forward and says, nope, now we want this to be a rule out. Here are all our allegations on rule out without, you know, a verified affidavit, only on pleadings, a memo of law. And so we get to a hearing, at which point our client is not able to affirmatively respond from an evidentiary perspective.
Okay, now I'm confused. Judge Larkin, you...
Did you then object at the hearing saying, wait a minute, we're here on an intervention motion. They've now raised a separate and distinct issue of statutory rule out. We want time and adequate notice to respond to that motion by the county.
That is also my question. And then my question is, what do you want us to do about that? Because you haven't raised that in your appeal.
Well, that is the basis for our appeal, I would argue, Your Honor. That is the basis. Is that, I mean, that's part of it. We argued the procedural issues in our primary brief, our appellate brief.
I interrupted Judge Larkin's question because I thought my question was hinged on hers. Hers is the same thing I was going to ask. I understood, just because now I'm really confused, Ms. Osmond. I thought you said in your initial remarks that you were not appealing the motion for intervention, the denial of that motion. That's what I thought I heard you say.
We are not appealing the decision on the intervention. The court made separate determinations on ruling out the party under 260C. We're appealing the decision of the court to basically rule us out as an adoptive placement and basically circumvent the prima facie requirement under 260C.607 subdivision 6. So the court made many decisions beyond the motion for intervention. We are appealing the piece that prevents us from being involved in this case moving forward via the statutory right to bring a motion for adoptive placement, which doesn't require you to have the child in your care. Many people that bring a motion for adoptive placement do not have the child in their care. That's part of the purpose of the motion, is to say we should have that child in our care. So in this case, the district court said, fine, if there's no finalization of the adoption, there we didn't meet the 12-month standard. So therefore, that exclusivity, right? Those statutes are about exclusivity of who can be placed or who can be the placement. So we're taking these statutes on exclusivity, and then we're saying because this wasn't met, which we argue was actually due to the county more than our clients, because our clients did cooperate at every level of signing the adaptive placement agreement. So we have exclusivity. That moves us on to the statutes about notice. Notice is about suitability, right? It says a suitable adoptive or foster placement. And it specifically references relatives and foster parents differently. But either way, it's about suitability. Suitability, we talk about, can you be licensed? Can you get a home study? It's that ability to weed out people that wouldn't be able to have a child placed with them for adoption.
But your clients have conditioned any request to have this child on certain things occurring. I mean, as far as I understand the record, that conditioning of treatment still precedes any request by your clients for the adoption to move forward. Does that not appear to be in conflict with a child's best interests?
Well, I think that it's absolutely not in conflict, because the entire point of the best interest is to get the child the services they need. In fact, that's one thing that under 260C.607 subdivision 2, the court is required to inquire about at every review hearing is what services are we providing to this child?
What then would the point of the statute be that says an adoption needs to be finalized within 12 months? I mean, we assume that our statutes are not absurd and they're designed for achievement of a particular purpose.
Yes, that I would agree with that, but it doesn't say if it's not done within 12 months, the foster parents can no longer adopt the child. It just removes the exclusivity. And it also specifically talks about finding a new adoptive placement, which has not happened. It doesn't say they are no longer ever able to adopt this child. And when you look at the timeline here, the county did not even submit the APA to DHS until almost 6 months after the consent to adopt was signed. Our clients were never given a final APA approved by DHS. They were never given the opportunity to finalize. And I do think there's a distinction here, and this is part of the difficulty in not having an actual contested hearing, which was allowed under SAW for rule out, is that our clients never said we won't adopt. Even in the court's transcript from the September hearing, they said they still want to adopt. We recognize they still want to adopt. What they said is we want a simultaneous placement while we are still pursuing the adoption for him to get the treatment that he needs in a residential treatment facility. So they could have adopted and then had him go to a residential treatment facility and still had that paid by, you know, public insurance. But they were saying, we want to make sure that the county is following
up.
Right,
I got to bring this up because it's an important feature of the record. I understand that your clients did not want to adopt and then have the child proceed to treatment. The adoption was on condition that he be in a treatment, residential treatment program or a treatment program to address his acting out needs.
That is not, our clients never said that is not anything that they ever stated. That is, those are representations of the department, and our clients were not allowed to go on the record at the hearing to refute that. What they said was, sorry, Judge Larkin, are you?
Oh, you can finish, but one
sorry. It's so hard on Zoom sometimes to, what they said was I want to make it very clear. They were never given the opportunity to finalize the adoption. They signed the APA. They said all along, we do want to adopt, but we also want him placed in a facility or a treatment option for him to meet these needs. I mean, I think it's very concerning that the district court isn't asking, why isn't the county doing this for this child? They talk about how he's, you know, one of the most severely traumatized children they've worked with. And yet the entire time he's with our clients, he has minimal resources for meeting these therapeutic needs. So our clients have never, ever said, we will not adopt unless you do this. What they said was, we would like him to have these treatment options while we move forward with the adoption. They were never given the APA. They were never asked to petition. The county never filed a petition. They signed the APA within days of getting it. So what they asked for was a simultaneous placement, which happens, of a mental health treatment for this child while they move forward with the adoption.
So counsel, as I understand, I just had an opportunity to look at your brief again. Your first issue regarding the rule out is that it's supposed to be a two-step process, a notice that the county intends to rule somebody out, and then a district court finding that the person should be ruled out, and the person who is seeking placement has the right to some sort of evidentiary hearing on which the decision to rule out should be based. And your complaint is that your clients didn't get the evidentiary hearing. You only had 2 days notice of the rule out. And this, again, I want to ask, at that hearing, did you say, we object, we're entitled to an evidentiary hearing, we want to continue this issue for such a hearing?
We did not represent them at the hearing. From the, my understanding of the transcript was that that was not explicitly stated in that way, that there were concerns raised about how they weren't able to respond, how the judge specifically states in the transcript, I understand that you haven't had the opportunity to fully review these and respond to these questions. So that was all noted in the transcript that this.
So your argument to us would be what the judge should have done under those circumstances is not make the rule out determination that under case law is final and precludes a petition to adopt, but the judge should have set the matter for some sort of evidentiary hearing to provide an opportunity for both sides to be heard before making that decision.
Exactly. I believe that under JLG and under SAW, that is the correct method in which to move forward with a rule out, given how much impact a rule out has on a party's ability to ever move forward with questioning the reasonableness of the placement.
Right. Thank you. We will now hear from counsel for respondents. Who is going first?
Your Honor, I will go first.
Okay, please introduce yourself and let us know which party you represent and begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Stephanie Wiersma, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney on behalf of the respondent, Ramsey County Social Services Department. Ramsey County asks that this court affirm the district court order in all respects. Your Honors, as has been discussed, the appellants seek to conflate and confuse the issues before the court today. In this case, a consent to adopt was signed in October 2020, and the appellants began to work through the adoption process. After twice requesting the removal of the child, once after the APA was signed in January of 2021, and again in April of 2021, the appellants notified the agency that the child must be removed from their care and have never fully committed to having him returned to their care. Today, appellants appeal seeking the right for adoptive placement if they decide they want to adopt him in the future. As noted, the appellants are not appealing the decision on intervention. Your Honors, for today's argument, Ramsey County will be splitting with respondents, the counsel for the child. The agency is going to argue that the issues raised today are not properly before this court and that the rule out was consistent with statute and case law. Ms. Doherty is counsel for the child and will be addressing the issue of the consent to adopt as well as the best interest of the child.
Okay, could you address this procedural issue that has been raised? I mean, I'm hearing you state facts that would support a rollout. What record was presented for the district court for it to make the decision on the rollout when you got to that hearing? Did people just make arguments or was an evidentiary record created?
Your Honor, the agency, along with its motions, submitted a memorandum of law as well as supporting exhibits, which were accepted into the record. The judge also heard arguments on the record. I think it's important to note this morning, Your Honors, that the appellants at the time of the hearing in September did not object to moving forward on the motion on the merits. They never objected to the form, structure, or timing of the hearing.
They didn't ask for an evidentiary hearing. I just want to be clear on that. The appellants at the time, did they ask the judge to have a continuance for an evidentiary hearing, or was the manner in which this was moving forward agreed upon?
Your Honor, they did request an evidentiary hearing for the issues raised by the county. However, an evidentiary hearing is not required by Minnesota Statute 260C607 Subdivision 2.
Okay, so they asked for an evidentiary hearing because they just received notice that this was going to a rule-out determination, and the district court denied it?
Your Honor, the I don't believe the district court made a determination as to whether or not an evidentiary hearing was required. However, at the hearing, appellants proceeded forward with arguments on the merits of the motion.
But I mean, did they proceed forward with arguments on the merits of the motion because they said, we want an evidentiary hearing, and the judge did not say, you know, I have a hard time faulting someone for proceeding forward on the merits of the motion if that party has asked for an evidentiary hearing, which implies, you know, a different hearing or a continuance, and the judge doesn't address it and instead just goes forward with arguments on the motion. That sort of implies that there will be no continued hearing, and it's now or never in terms of what you need to present in terms of the substance of the motion.
Your Honor, at the time of the request for the evidentiary, the judge did not make an explicit ruling as to whether or not he would grant an evidentiary. Instead, arguments went forward on the merits.
Wasn't the request tacitly denied?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, that by moving forward and hearing arguments, that is a tacit denial of the evidentiary. However, case law and statute do not require an evidentiary hearing.
It might not require a live evidentiary hearing with witness testimony, but doesn't due process require at the very least notice opportunity to be heard? Wouldn't that be sufficient notice that enables a party to put forth its affidavits, its documents, its factual side of the dispute?
Your Honor,
just arguments on the issue. I mean, you, the county came forward with a memorandum and affidavits or documents to support its position. Did appellants have an opportunity to do that at the hearing at which the court heard arguments and eventually decided the issue?
The appellants had the opportunity to make their arguments on the record. They never requested the opportunity to be able to file affidavits. And in fact, they did file a supplemental filing with the court.
Isn't this where Judge Smith, I'm looking at Judge Smith's order right now. I recall there being an order, perhaps not in the overall meritorious order, but somewhere where he extended the timeline so that he didn't have to rule within the statutory timelines to allow appellant counsel to submit additional documents and supporting materials. This record is huge, so that's why I'm asking you. You're more familiar with it than me.
That is correct, Your Honor. Appellants did submit a supplemental filing with the court advancing arguments on the merits as well, and they did request at the time that the foster parents be ordered into therapy with the foster child, as well as submitted additional arguments on the county's motion.
Very helpful then. So what we're hearing now is, although appellants objected and wanted more time to address this issue, the district court kept the record open so appellants could submit documentary support for their position. Is that accurate?
That is accurate, Your Honor. Your Honors, as well as being able to submit additional filings with the court, the appellants also made arguments at the time of the hearing, and statute and case law do not require an evidentiary hearing. In fact, both in JLG and in SAW, the court did rule that the relative was properly ruled out without an evidentiary hearing. This court has never found that an evidentiary hearing is required.
Just for everyone's benefit, it's right in front of me in Judge Smith's order. It's a very large footnote one, describing the process that happened when the appellants asked for a time period to submit additional information, which they did, and the court accepted it.
Thank you for that clarification, Your Honor. And I do see that I am almost out of time. The agency this morning does request that this court does affirm the district court's ruling in all respects. Thank you, Your Honors. I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Okay, we'll now hear from respondent attorney, and you're representing the child, Ms. Doherty?
Yes, Your Honor. Rachel Doherty on behalf of the respondent child this morning.
You may proceed.
As Ms. Wiersma previewed, I will be addressing the second of the two issues on appeal this morning, whether the district court abused its discretion when it determined that the adoption could not be finalized within the 12-month deadline. I'd like to focus on the child's wishes for a part of my argument this morning, but I know the court is interested in some of these procedural issues. I'd like to reorganize a little bit and start there and just outline.
Please tell us what the child would like.
Oh, you'd like the child first. Great. I can do that. The child's 11 years old. He's of an age where his wishes can and should be taken into account. It's been roughly 9 months since he's had contact with the Mahers. And throughout that period, he has been explicit and consistent in his desires. He does not want to have contact with the Mahers. He does not want the Mahers to adopt him. And he does not want them involved in his adoption proceedings. The significant abuse that he suffered earlier in his life deprived him of his agency and his self-determination in many ways. And he's trying to exercise some of that agency now and be clear about the lack of contact that he wants with the Mahers. The adults involved in this adoption proceeding should honor those wishes. To borrow the words of the child's guardian ad litem in the district court, the Mahers are understandably grieving the loss of this remarkable person in their lives, but we cannot lose sight of the child's wishes in an effort to appease them. He has strongly and repeatedly expressed that he does not want contact with them, and the district court did not abuse its discretion when it issued an order that aligned with those wishes. I want to turn now to the procedure below and just really outline all of the process that the Mahers did receive. They had notice of the hearing, and this wasn't an issue that popped up for the first time 2 days before. This had been bubbling for 6 months. He had been out of the Mahers' home for almost 6 months, and the agency filed a motion. The Mahers had notice. The district court held a hearing. The Mahers were represented by an attorney at the hearing who made all of the factual arguments that the Mahers now make on appeal. If you go back and look at that transcript, all of the same factual complaints that they have now, they made them below. And then even after the hearing, the Mahers were allowed to submit additional argument evidence over the objection of the agency. And so the district court considered the whole adoption factual record, as well as anything the Mahers wanted to submit. They receive virtually every process that is available to them in our judicial system, and they just are not entitled to an evidentiary hearing under the law. I want to now turn to the merits. You know, I think the only folks here who are conflating issues are the Mahers. The district court had three issues before it: permissive intervention, failure to finalize the adoption within 12 months, and rule out. If you read that district court's order, they separately addressed each one. The district court separately addressed the law and did a separate analysis for each piece. And the only one who's now trying to throw that all into a blender and make it confusing is the Mahers, because when you separate those out and you just look at the plain language of the statute and the facts that the district court had, it's very clear that there was no abuse of discretion here. On the second issue, the failure to finalize, we have a consent to adopt agreement here, which means there was a 12-month deadline. And the Mahers had an exclusive adoptive placement option for that child for 12 months until the district court found that the adoption couldn't be finalized. There's not a statutory interpretation dispute here on the failure to finalize, I don't believe. I think we're all on the same page. And if you just apply that statute to the facts, it's really clear. The consent to adopt was signed in October of 2020. That triggered the 12-month period. The Mahers twice had the child removed, once at the 3-month mark, once at the 6-month mark, and the child was not returned to them after the 6-month mark. The agency made a motion when about a month was remaining on that 12-month period, and the district court held a hearing, as it was required to do under that statute. He then took the matter under advisement, and the 12-month deadline lapsed while the matter was under advisement. So by the time the district court issued its decision in October of 2021, the deadline already passed. The district court did not abuse its discretion in finding that the adoption could not be finalized within 12 months when the adoption had not, in fact, been finalized in 12 months. The Mahers' argument on appeal mainly seems to be that if some different hypothetical facts had happened, that maybe they could have finalized the adoption. I count about 4 to 5 contingencies in their briefs about the things that would have had to happen to make this adoption be finalized within 12 months. And that just misses the mark. The statute is clear that this is about finding permanency for children as quickly as possible. And the district court doesn't need to look at hypothetical facts and a hypothetical motion made at a different time. The district court needs to look at the facts that, as it had them. And it did that here, and its decision was not an abuse of discretion. And one more piece on the procedural issues here before I sum up, unless there are any other questions. In addition to the waiver arguments raised by Ms. Wiersma, I think the prejudice arguments are really essential here too. The Mahers don't have any prejudice. To mount a successful procedural challenge, they must not only show that they were entitled to an evidentiary hearing as a matter of law, they must show that they were prejudiced as a result of not receiving that evidentiary hearing. And they haven't done that. They made all of the same arguments below. They received so much process below, and it's not surprising that the Mahers have been unable to point to anything and say, this is why it matters that we didn't get an evidentiary hearing. In sum, the Mahers have tried to conflate the issues on appeal here and make this about a motion for adoptive placement that was never brought. The Mahers have not made a motion for an adoptive placement, and that issue is not before the court. What is at issue here are two simple questions. Could the Mahers' adoption have been finalized within 12 months? No. Is it in the child's best interest for the Mahers to be ruled out as an adoptive resource? Yes. These decisions are subject to deferential standards of review, and the Mahers have failed to overcome them. And moreover, the district court's decision was in line with the child's strongly expressed wishes. He does not want the Mahers to adopt him, and he does not want any further contact with them. He's been unwavering in that position for 9 months. The district court did not err when it issued a decision that honored the child's wishes. For these reasons and the reasons articulated by Ms. Wiersma, we ask that the district court's order be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now have rebuttal argument from Ms. Osvend. You may proceed.
Sorry, I'm mute. Thank you. Just to clarify, if the court looks at the transcript, page 5 and page 13, there's explicit requests for an evidentiary hearing that was explicitly asked for. On page 15, the district court also acknowledges that the appellants didn't know much of what had just been alleged by the county, so how could they respond to it? And when you look at the footnote 1 that was referred to by this court in the judge's order that is being appealed, it notes that the only additional information that was submitted were county documents. They were the court report, the social worker's court report, and in this. There's nothing that indicates that they were allowed or asked to submit an affidavit. There's nothing in the transcript where the judge allows them to do so. And as this court is aware, even if they had been permitted to provide a supplemental affidavit or pleadings, that just leads to a question of fact. And this is exactly why we have evidentiary hearings, because we have questions of fact that need to be pled out in front of the court and need to be heard.
Would the record support the idea that the district court disallowed your clients from presenting affidavit evidence?
There's nothing that says that precisely. What I would say is that the transcript indicates that the judge acknowledges that there was a lack of notice and a lack of knowledge of the information, but does not agree to an evidentiary hearing and also does not state that they will allow substantive pleadings to be filed in response, given this lack of notice. As I said, the evidentiary hearing was asked for twice, and in the court footnote, there's no reference to being permitted to respond with substantive pleadings. So I guess it's a statement of by omission. I forget, you know, the exact title. Well, I mean, but no, there is nothing expressly denying a request for affidavits.
In a practical world, I guess I assume in litigation, if one party presents affidavits, despite there being no evidentiary hearing, and the district court allows those affidavits, that the presumption is that all parties get to present affidavits, whether requested or not. So was there ever an effort to present affidavits?
I am not aware of anything beyond what's in the record to do that. I just know that there was a repeated request for a hearing, an evidentiary hearing. And I will note that the county did not present an affidavit. They did a motion memorandum of law, and the district court accepted the statements from the county as factual without allowing appellants to testify at the hearing or even present testimony evidence.
So is there case law? Is there a case law that would take the requirements under 260C 607, that the district court find after a hearing that the hearing necessarily needs to be an evidentiary type hearing with witnesses, presentation versus motion hearing?
I would say that in MLS and SAW and JLG, where there's discussions of rule outs, the time that the Court of Appeals upheld the rule out was in SAW, where there was a full contested hearing. And that was part of the basis for supporting the decision to rule out.
But would that be a district court discretion? What I'm getting at, is there anything that you found as far as your research that says the right to a hearing, an evidentiary hearing, trumps the right to have a hearing with supporting documents submitted after the fact, which happened here?
Well, 260C.607 discussing a hearing required for rule out does not expressly state evidentiary hearing, but it does have rules on what needs to be done and considered for a hearing under that statute. But I do think the case law makes it very clear that a rule out is a very important measure that restricts the ability to be involved with the case at any level, and that that's something that needs to be done.
If we disagree with you, Ms. Osband, mm-hmm. and we determine that, in fact, the hearing was adequate, if that happened, mm-hmm. Is there something that you wish to argue that was incorrect about the court's determination?
Well, I think what was incorrect was that the court took what the county stated as fact, almost like the county was making a prima facie case, and then noted that our clients did not present alternate evidence when they'd only done an affidavit on their motion to intervene, which was the initial motion that was scheduled. I would also note briefly that what the child wants is one factor under best interest factors, but there was argument that we're also dealing with a child who's deeply traumatized and has been cut off from all contact. The county won't allow contact. So what this child has been told about why he was removed from the home and there's no contact moving forward is very important in understanding how that child views the appellant's love and care for him.
Judge Larkin, the time has expired. May I ask one more question?
Of course you may.
Ms. Osband, what exactly do you want us to do on behalf of your clients?
We would like you to reverse the explicit decision in the order that states that the motion to rule out is granted. That was an explicit decision. And remand on that matter for an evidentiary hearing or contested hearing on the rule out, which would allow them to then potentially move forward with a motion for adoptive placement.
So despite all the documents that have been submitted and considered, you want us to send it back for an evidentiary hearing?
Well, I mean, ideally the reversal of the rule out and finding that the rule out was inappropriate, and then they're not ruled out and we can move forward with the motion for adoptive placement. Alternatively, if there was a remand, at least that the remand require a contested hearing on the rule out issue. But ideally that there's a reversal of the rule out based on an error of law. And then that allows our clients to then move forward with the motion for adoptive placement, which requires them to make a prima facie showing. And if they don't make that, they don't make that. But that's exactly why we have the ability under the statute to bring that prima facie case.
Thank you for the arguments in this very important case. You'll have our decision within the expedited timeline of 45 days. We appreciate your arguments in the briefing, and that concludes the hearing.
Thank you very much.